We're talking about economic impact studies here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Developers who work on projects like sports arenas and performing arts centers want to get a shovel in the ground, and they need to make a case that the project will be a boon for a community, and they need numbers to back that up. So these economic development studies measure the effect of the jobs created, the tourism, the spending, and they put a number on the ripple effect. But economic impact numbers are based on estimates that may or may not be accurate. And Mika Solner has been writing about these projects based on economic development studies. She's a political reporter at USA Today Network Wisconsin. Mika, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
The Fox Cities Champion Center is this new community sports center in Grand Chute that is supposed to open in October, and it's estimated to bring in nearly $9 million in direct spending the first year it's open. But you've looked into these kind of estimates and found that they're not always reliable. What's going on?
Yeah, so there's a couple factors that play a role in whether or not something might pan out. So what we found in the Fox Cities is most of the projections that they've taken for large projects like that one, for example, tend to actually overcompensate for what they originally estimated their value to be economically. And that's for a couple reasons. That's because officials here will plug in really conservative numbers when they're looking at what the potential impact may be. And also depends on what kind of software you use. Yeah, there are, you know, various factors that play a role in looking at whether the accuracy of the economic impact that's being calculated is going to pan out. But so far, we've been okay in this area.
And so when we hear about how much money a new development is going to bring into a community, what does that number really mean? What does that ripple effect mean?
So it's just an estimate. So it is a way of kind of letting the public know, as well as, you know, being confident in the project, saying this is what the impact is going to be in our local area and in the region. So it's kind of a way to boost this project and say, you know, this is a way to strengthen tourism in our area. It's going to bring a lot of jobs, and this is going to be the overall economic impact of it, despite what the cost might be in the beginning.
You talked to these business owners in the Fox Cities. What did they have to say about how these major developments like the Fox Cities Performing Arts Center have impacted the local economy?
So business leaders in the community argue that, you know, much of their economic impact has a lot to do with indirect spending in the area as well. For example, I spoke with, you know, the director of the Performing Arts Center. You know, she says that people who come in and see shows may not always be from the area, and therefore may be spending more in our local area for whether it's businesses or eating at our restaurants or staying in hotels. So that generates a lot more of economic activity than just that one project that they're here for.
Yeah, in the words like may and could, I mean, there's a lot of projection out there. You don't really know exactly what's going on.
Right. And there are consequences of when that can fall short. And that really depends on, you know, a couple different factors when taking in the calculation and when they're kind of looking at, you know, what they're actually projecting it to be.
We're talking about economic development studies and what they mean with Mika Solner. She is a political reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. Do you live in the Fox Cities or Milwaukee or Mount Pleasant or Racine? What are your feelings about how the Fox Cities Champion Center or the Fox Cities Performing Arts Center or the Pfizer Forum, for that matter, or Foxconn could affect your community's economy? Have you looked closely at the numbers? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Mika, did people you spoke with feel that there were positive effects on the community as a whole that went beyond revenues or any of the calculations or the number crunching that went on in these studies?
Typically, yes. I did speak to local businesses that were kind of in close proximity to where these major attractions are in the area. What they're saying is, like, yes, when they do have an event or something is going on related to that project, that they are typically seeing more revenue come in, depending on what type of business they are. And if they aren't typically seeing more consumer spending, then they are definitely seeing, more people in the area. So it does give them exposure to people who may not be from here. So it may be an opportunity for them to return and purchase something in the future. So there are definitely some positive benefits.
Mika, you were saying earlier that you input some conservative numbers in these software systems to basically feed out these economic development studies on the other end. Is this like proprietary software that economic developers are using? And perhaps, if you use one, you'll get different calculations than using another.
I believe so. I think the majority of the software that's being used here in the Fox Valley, one that I looked at was called InPlan. What it does is it looks at what the regional overall activity in the area is, and then the people kind of estimating these projects can plug in their own numbers. So it really, really depends on what you put into the software that's going to spit out the projected outcome. So, if you're putting in more conservative numbers, you're gonna tend to probably be on target or maybe even, overreach your expected projections for a project or company that's coming in.
And so basically then, economic impact, how is that calculated? What are some of those numbers that you put in to get some of those calculations?
So to actually calculate economic impact, you're going to look at a variety of factors. One is looking at geography. So you're looking at, where is the revenue estimate going to reach? Is it going to reach the entire city, the county, and most likely you're looking at the regional impact as well. You're probably going to talk to stakeholders of, whether it's a company or you're building a project, of what their expectations are for visitor spending. And you're also probably going to consider what the state of the economy looks like at the time. Right now, we're seeing a strong one, so that might compel local leaders to maybe take on these big projects more so than they would if we were in a recession.
What are some of the potential consequences of getting an economic impact estimate wrong?
Yeah, so there's a few different consequences that can occur if there are errors that are related to calculating economic impact. One is normally, for example, if there's a company that's coming in and it's a public-private partnership with the municipality, they're offering incentives and they don't typically bring in as much as that was expected. That is a taxpayer incentive that has kind of been, essentially wasted. Secondly, with that, it also normally costs a lot of money to build these kind of projects, as well as maybe, if you are giving incentives. Again, like that's a huge cost to public money that's being spent. So if they aren't really giving in as much as expected, then that's, that may put a municipality into more debt as well.
As we wrap up here, Foxconn has been under the microscope and those numbers have been certainly in front of us. What about private companies that are being offered tax incentives based on these economic impact studies?
Yeah, so again, I think that if you are offering incentives, like it is, experts have said that it's critical that governments look at what the actual impact is going to be, make sure they take everything into consideration. Otherwise, it's likely that they may, that's going to be a debt on taxpayers, or it's just going to be, a huge expense that's not completely covered by the overall benefit of it.
Mika, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Mika Solner is a political reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, and we've been talking about the number crunching behind economic development projects. Coming up, it's landfills in Wisconsin and the largest one trying to expand in Menominee Falls. Do you live near a landfill? What is it like? Do you notice the economic impact for your area? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in just a minute to talk landfills here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Wisconsin landfills and waste management here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The owners of the Orchard Ridge landfill in Menominee Falls are asking the DNR if they can dig up contaminated waste and move it elsewhere on the property to make room for more garbage and extend the life of the landfill by about 2 decades. The Waukesha County Environmental Action League is concerned about potential environmental threats from such expansion. What questions do you have about our state's waste management? Are you in local government? What do you watch for and consider when disposing of your community's waste? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Jim Tingem is a professor in the College of Engineering at UW-Madison. His expertise includes environmental remediation and sustainability, and he teaches landfill design and management. Previously, he was a consultant at an engineering firms in the U.S. and has worked on nearly 36 landfill sites. Jim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we're going to talk a lot about the Menominee Falls landfill in just a bit. But first, can you give us an overall look at Wisconsin's waste situation? Where are we?
Yeah, we are at only 58 or so large permitted landfills. So consider across the entire state with 72 counties, we only have 58 landfills. So what that means is they're more regional, they're larger. And just compared to 2 decades ago where we had, 1,500 landfills across the state.
Now, DNR makes that point as well on its website saying, look, we have dozens of landfills today. Back, decades ago, there were town dumps everywhere. And were those unregulated?
They were unregulated. Growing up in West Central Wisconsin in the 70s and 80s, I remember our town dump actually going out there and on a Saturday and basically just backing up and unloading and walking away. And so that was townships and cities across the state and across the country. That was the way of doing business 40, 50 years ago.
What was the turning point? Why did that change?
Well, in 1976, we passed a resource conservation and recovery, or RCRA, and that was basically the first attempt to permit and design with modern technologies, because several of these sites across the country started to have groundwater pollution. And linking groundwater pollution to these landfills, state regulatory agencies, the United States Environmental Protection Agency, started stepping in and figuring out what do we need to do this better.
And so have things improved for the better? Because what we have now seems to be consolidated efforts around landfills. There are 58, but, these are very large landfills. Which way is better?
Well, I think the larger is better, because one thing is many people don't want these in their backyard, so they're extremely hard to permit, community groups, neighbors, townships, and the like. So just the political permitting process basically pushes you towards keeping existing sites going and expanding them. A new landfill, probably a 10-year permitting process and public relations process, that's a long time to wait to see if you get capacity to dispose of our waste that everyone in the U.S. and Wisconsin throws away every day.
So you're saying it takes about a decade to get a landfill up and running?
A new landfill, yes.
New landfill.
On a greenfield site.
We're talking about landfills and waste management here in Wisconsin with Jim Tingem. He's a UW-Madison professor who teaches landfill design and management. Do you live in a community near a landfill? Are there any negative side effects? Do you notice the economic impact for your area? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Jim, let's look at Menominee Falls, the state's largest landfill. They were granted an expansion in the spring, and now they'd like to expand again or try this other strategy to make room for more garbage. What is going on that site?
So first, remember that I said 1976 was when you basically made the first attempt to legislate and provide guidance for landfills. Well, that existing site in Menominee Falls, that disposal occurred from the 1950s to only the early 70s. So it was prior to anybody really thinking about the environmental consequences or design. So that is a Superfund site that is, which is administered by the United States Environmental Protection Agency, overseen by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And that 1.3 million cubic yards of old waste is sitting there without any modern engineering controls on the bottom. It has been closed, and they limit infiltration. So it is a Superfund site, and the opportunity is to move that material to a permitted engineered location and actually, in the long run, be better for the environment.
So even though that old site is contained and it is a Superfund site, you're saying that to move it then to a more technologically advanced site would perhaps be better?
It would be better, in my technical opinion, as far as minimization of leachate or the water that contacts waste and potentially goes into the groundwater table. So where we can control that. However, there are short-term concerns in moving waste, primarily nuisance odors, because when you excavate or exhume old waste, you know, it smells. It has that hydrogen sulfide rotten egg odor. It has some volatile organic compounds in it. So the short term, there's a lot of issues with nuisance odors, worker safety, transportation, lots of trucks moving, things like that. So there, it is a balancing act.
Help us understand more of these Superfund sites. Is a Superfund site just an old landfill? And what are some of the stipulations that are attached to Superfund sites? Okay.
Well, first, Superfund, the legislation was passed in 1980, so that's about how long it's been. And basically what it did is attempt to identify and remediate abandoned waste sites, whether they're landfills, industrial disposal sites, anything with environmental contamination. There are, I believe, about 1,400 listed Superfund sites in the United States. About 350 have been delisted or removed. And so actually, I would assume that the owners of this site would hope to delist this site if this process goes through.
So it sounds like they're saying that if they move this waste, they not only make room for more garbage, that perhaps they will be able to be delisted as a Superfund site.
That is correct. And one thing to note in Wisconsin is that the owners of the waste are perpetually responsible for the environmental issues with that waste. So if they can control it better, it's also advantageous to them as mitigating their long-term environmental risk.
So how does moving it give them more room for more waste?
More efficient. So basically, as far as airspace goes, so you remove waste that was disposed of without certain slopes into the ground and height, and basically, and then consolidate it and compact it, you can get significantly additional fill, especially if you go vertically higher than you were before.
Hmm. So you're saying crunch that waste together much more compactly and go higher.
Exactly.
And I understand this landfill is already 16 stories high.
Yes.
So is moving and recontaining waste, is that a common strategy in waste management?
It is becoming a more common strategy. It's been done at Glacier Ridge here near Horicon in Wisconsin. That was also a Superfund site, and they moved a little bit more waste than what we have here. So we have precedent in Wisconsin for doing a very similar project. Also, I believe a project was done in La Crosse. The La Crosse County landfill also had a consolidation. Generally, people don't do it or owners don't do it because it's very expensive.
You mentioned smell and off gases. What are the other concerns here from the DNR and the local community about doing this type of tactic at this landfill?
Well, transportation. There's to move 1.3 million cubic yards. Let me give you a perspective of how much
that
is.
Yeah.
So that's about 15 football fields, about 20 feet deep. Something like that, the quick math, maybe a little less. So that's a huge amount of trucks that have to go in there under proper health and safety concerns, excavate it, move it into the new site, compact it. So it's just that's a long effort. months and months of waste removal to accomplish this task.
Are there concerns about when you do that process that there's leaching or groundwater concerns?
Well, not necessarily, because we're actually excavating the waste that could contribute to that. One thing that I'm sure that the Department of Natural Resources will be looking at is how deep do they need to go? So do they need to go a couple feet below the waste, 5 feet? How deep has potential contamination gone underneath? And so those things will all, I'm sure, be looked at in the various review process that are coming forward. Our Department of Natural Resources are leaders internationally and nationally on this type of area. We led the moment or the movement in the 70s. The United States Environmental Protection Agency actually took a lot of the Wisconsin regulations and took it into their
federal practices.
So we have a history here in Wisconsin to do this type of thing.
Talking with UW-Madison Professor Jim Tingem, teaching landfill design and management. You can join in. Do you work in waste management? What are your thoughts on landfill expansion? What other strategies should be considered? What questions do you have about our state's waste management? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this conversation after a news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about landfills, Superfund sites, and waste management practices. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Operators of our state's largest landfill, Orchard Ridge and Menominee Falls, they're asking the DNR to approve an expansion by moving contaminated waste on its property to make room for new garbage and then therefore extend the life of the landfill by about 2 decades. The DNR regulates landfills. There are just dozens in the state, around 58, compared to thousands of town dumps and other disposal sites a few decades ago. Are you in local government? What do you watch for and consider when disposing of your community's waste? Do you try to limit your own waste in your day-to-day life? Are you hopeful it has an impact on our world's garbage? Join in with your thoughts, your questions about landfills at 800-642-1234. Jim Tingem is a professor in the College of Engineering at UW-Madison, and he teaches landfill design and management, and he stays with us. Jim, is lack of space a growing struggle in the landfill industry? What is it like out there for space?
It's not only a growing struggle, but it also consolidates the industry because there's only certain larger companies that can afford that expense to go through a large permitting process. So that's why you see only the larger counties with the financial resources to own and operate landfills, in addition to a small handful of large national companies that have the resources to participate in this area.
So what do counties do when they start running out of space?
Well, number one is they'll start discreetly looking for new landfill sites because, as you can imagine, with any development, once word gets out that they're looking at a site, the prices start going up. So if a county can't find that space readily, they'll go to the private sector and say, you know, we're out of space, and then the private landfill haulers will go to those private landfills.
You've researched ways the gas emitted from landfills can be collected. What have you found?
Well, in this world of global warming and considerations, landfills internationally are a very large contributor to greenhouse gases, primarily because of methane. Methane is a gas due to the decomposition of organic material. And the methane, a better word for it, is natural gas. So we can clean up that methane and remove and scrub out the hydrogen sulfide and volatile organic compounds. And we can use that to burn it for make electricity. We can convert it to biodiesel. Dane County Landfill is taking that gas, and they're actually putting it onto the natural gas pipeline that runs by the county landfill as a high BTU gas. So in this area and state, when you turn on your natural gas stove, part of that gas might be coming from a landfill. So kind of interesting on the full circle. You throw it out in your trash, and you know, a year or two later and maybe coming back into your house.
Is that the same kind of technique used in like methane digesters on dairy farms?
It's very similar. The bugs are a little bit different, the aerobic environment, but that's exactly what we're doing is we are beneficially harvesting the byproduct of anaerobic digestion of organics.
Well, let's take a call now. Let's go to Steve in West Bend. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Have you explored, after you've capped off a large volume of this, you know, mixed bag of organic material, the injection of accelerants that would hasten the decomposition of the material, where, you know, is actually the volume would be lessened because of the breakdown of all the organic material?
Well, thanks, Steve. We don't actually inject chemicals, but we find that we can recirculate water or leachate into the waste that will accelerate it because the bugs need moisture for that composition. So the easiest thing to do, it has environmental and engineering concerns, is to inject moisture, leachate that you collect at the bottom of the landfill, and several sites will then re-inject that into the waste to give the bugs the environment that they like to accelerate that decomposition.
And landfill design and operation, that has certainly changed over the decades. What are some of those advances looking like?
Well, the biggest advances are in containment, where we used to just throw the trash out on the ground and hope for the best. Now, in Wisconsin, we put plastic on the bottom of landfills and also 4 feet of compacted clay. Those kind of act like a Reese's peanut butter cup. It's you combining the plastic with the backstop of the clay that really limits the transport of liquid through that liner system. And we also put sand or small gravel on top of that layer, and we collect the leachate at the bottom of the landfill, and we remove it and we treat it. So we are treating leachate in landfills, and we have really good high quality liner systems that are engineered for lives of 100 years of performance.
And when you say leachate, what is in that? What does that mean?
So leachate is a witch's brew of material. So everything that you throw out in your trash, either accidentally or on purpose, batteries, paint thinners, organics, all of those residuals can find themselves into that leachate or water that comes in contact with the trash. Now, the best thing to do, like Dane County does and many other places, is clean sweep and similar to remove those paint thinners and aerosols and the like so they never get into the landfill, but some of it still makes it there. So all of those are going to be residuals in the leachate of a landfill.
How much of a problem is that? Are we developing ways to dispose of those other chemicals properly? I know there are paint drop-offs and battery drop-offs, but is that really working, or are these things getting into our general landfills?
It is working. Those recycling and management systems take a large amount of it out, but you know, still some of it makes its way into the trash, so we have a ways to go, and we still have to treat that leachate, usually by sending it to a wastewater treatment plant adjacent to the landfill.
We're talking about landfills with Jim Tingem. He's a professor at UW-Madison teaching landfill design and management. Do you work in waste management? What are your thoughts on landfill expansion? What other strategies should we be considering? And what questions do you have about our state's waste management system? Join in. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Sharon called and couldn't stay with us, but Sharon said about how waste is treated in other countries like Sweden. Is there anything you're watching around the world that could see working here? Sharon says Sweden, for example, burns their trash.
Yes, so incineration of trash, some of the eastern states, Minnesota has a fair number of incinerators. It has its own challenges. Number one is when you burn trash, there's a lot of air emissions, so you really have to manage those air emissions in just in a different setting. And there's still going to be residuals from that incineration that you have to put into a landfill. So it does consolidate the amount that you have to put into a landfill, and it can be quite expensive.
Modern landfills, they grow up instead of out. How does that work, and why is that?
Well, primarily because neighbors start to come closer to the landfill. So a landfill may be in place for 20 or 30 years, and neighborhoods encroach on them, so there's not space most of the time to go laterally. Also, the Department of Natural Resources requires certain setbacks from property lines and sensitive habitats such as wetlands. So with that limited ability to go laterally, we go higher.
What are some novel things that you've seen in consulting around the country? Novel and not so novel. I mean, we have put waste on barges and sent them out. We have put waste in San Francisco area, you know, building on top of waste. What are you seeing out there?
Well, one of my things I'm seeing is management of plastic residuals. There's a lot of outcry because of the amount of plastics, especially in developing countries, that make it into our oceans and the like, and are really impacting. So really, I think my technical opinion, the best management strategy is to keep trash in modern landfills. We are developing better materials. So just as an example, I want to give you a comparison about research that we're doing at UW-Madison. Similar to Pampers or adult diapers, they are developing new polymers that absorb moisture, whether that's from your baby's behind or at the bottom of a landfill. So the same products that are going into diapers, we're also considering putting in at the bottom of landfills to absorb any of those contaminants before they can get out into the environment. We have new plastic materials that limit the diffusion of contaminants through that. So science and technology is gaining a stead here in this area. So even though we have modern landfills, we're getting better and better at containing that waste.
And it's all about containing, it sounds like, that is the key. Even though having a site and the amount of property to contain it all is also a challenge.
Yeah, it is a challenge. Let's say that for every 100 feet of landfill height in 20 years, it's probably going to consolidate probably at least 20 feet. So it's going to compress and settle as that biodegradation occurs and consolidation happens. Long term, you know, we have to continue to look at prairie habitats, bike paths, walking paths, or long-term uses for closed landfills. So this complex of landfills in Menominee Falls, you know, 30 years from now, we're going to be looking at, okay, what is that long-term use for this?
We're talking about landfills with Jim Tingem, who's a professor at UW-Madison who teaches landfill design and management. You can join in. What questions do you have about how landfills are designed and maintained? Do you live near one? What is that like? What are your thoughts on Superfund sites? Do you have environmental concerns? Number is 800-642-1234. Back in just a minute. Stay with us. More conversation ahead on the Ideas Network. We're talking about waste management in Wisconsin, how landfills are designed, and what we know about Superfund sites. The DNR regulates landfills in the state. The largest one is asking to expand. Landfill operators in our state are required by code to monitor groundwater, surface water, and, where appropriate, air and soil to ensure that their facilities are not emitting contaminants that could harm public health or the environment. So do you live in a community near a landfill? Are there negative side effects? Do you notice the economic impact for your area? What are your thoughts on landfills? Join in at 800-642-1234. UW-Madison professor Jim Tingem stays with us. He's an expert on landfills and their design. Let's go back to the phones now with Dave joining us from Appleton. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Yeah, I'm in Outagamie County, and I think there is an agreement between Brown County, Winnebago County, and Outagamie where they dump garbage at their local place, then they repack it onto semis, then they transfer it to one of those other locations, and then dump it at those locations. And I'm just trying to figure out the efficiency of this.
Dave, thanks.
Yeah, so it's an economical efficiency, to be perfectly honest. So if you don't have a landfill in your county or there are cheaper tipping fees in the adjacent county, what that transfer company or organization will do is that how much is going to cost to own and manage a transfer station to take the smaller, well, quote-unquote, small garbage trucks that might have 12, 15 tons in them, and then transfer it to larger semis that have three times the capacity. They're burning diesel. It takes operators of those rigs. So it can be efficient if you're talking saving $20 a ton on disposal, but it's all an economical analysis if it's efficient or not.
Dave, thanks. Let's go to Adam in Madison. Adam, hi.
Hi. So, Jim, a question about the liner. And so if there's ever a rip in it or, you know, a tear at, like, the seams or something, you know, first, how do we figure out that there was a rip? And then secondly, you know, how do they repair that?
Adam, that's just a fantastic question, because you can imagine the plastic doesn't work if there's a rip in it. What we'll actually do is we'll inspect all those welds in the bottom of a landfill liner before we put the next layer. And we can actually now put geophysics, or we can put waves into the bottom of a landfill, and we can detect very small leaks by running water through them. So whether it is caused by a dozer blade or just a pinhole defect, we're getting very good at finding and repairing those holes. Adam, however, I want to be clear, you know, we're not perfect. Every landfill is going to have a few holes in those liners, one or two per acre. So that's why we have
and
compact,
be aware yeah. that there is that hole in, I mean, are these landfills aware of them?
If we're aware of them, we'll fix them, but there's always going to be a few that you can't find. And that's why we have clay underneath the plastic. It gives a backstop in case we don't find one of those small holes.
Let's go to, let's see here. And then how long do liners last? I mean, is there a shelf life here?
Yeah, so that's the advantage and disadvantage of plastic. The advantage is that they last hundreds and hundreds of years. The bad thing about plastics in our ocean or similar is they degrade very, very slowly. So hundreds of years, these plastics will last.
Let's go to Matt in West Alice. Matt, hi.
Hi. I know this is kind of a little bit off topic, but it's very related to it. In Japan, they take a lot of biomaterial that's being thrown away, food products and whatnot, and they recycle it into pig feed. Have we ever considered anything along those lines, or a widespread composting project? I tried to do it in my neighborhood once, but, you know, people aren't as willing as you would think they'd be.
Yeah, we do a couple of things with compost. Is number one, we try to keep compost separate from the landfill, because that compost takes up space, and it's more valuable to put our daily trash other than composted wood or similar. So it's just an economics, best use of that airspace. The other thing with compost is sometimes we'll put in an intermediate cover layers or daily cover so that we cover the waste at night and we mitigate those odors on short-term basis. And then that compost is going to degrade with time, and we can collect that energy in the form of methane in the landfill and beneficially reuse it. So we definitely look at compost in several different ways.
Let's go to Kathy in Eau Claire with thoughts on this. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. We live in Eau Claire. We are within a half mile of the Seven Mile Creek landfill. Daily, we experience a lower quality of life due to noise, heavy traffic, odors, debris, litter. And our property values are a great concern to us, as we have the visibility of a mountain growing. This is the fourth proposed expansion in our area. The garbage is, quarter of the garbage collected there is from out of state. Seven Mile Creek collects the most out-of-state garbage. It's very worrisome to all of us. We feel we have no protections from this landfill, and we realize other areas do, and just actually feel like we're living in the shadow of a monster. So we're wondering how, you know, I mean, you mentioned just a moment ago about some supposed environmental benefits of collecting the methane, but that is not happening at our landfill.
So Kathy is describing what it's like to be a neighbor to a landfill.
Yes, Kathy, you know, I can understand your concerns, and those are not just you. It's lots of people have those same concerns, and I grew up in Stanley, Wisconsin, not too far from Eau Claire, so I know exactly what landfill you're talking about. So I compare this to, like, the fracking sand industry in north of Eau Claire and in Bloomer. So you do have these industrial sites out typically towards the country, and one of the biggest issues is increased traffic. That is, it's a safety issue if the roads are not designed to handle that traffic. It is a nuisance as far as hearing that traffic, seeing that traffic, you know, as you say, quality of life. So these are trade-offs that we have to consider, but you do have a voice. Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, you know, takes all questions and comments. The landfill should be reaching out to the community and neighbors to discuss these issues. And just as one final benefit is the county or the district in that area should be collecting taxes on those tipping fees so that at least there are financial benefits for the school districts and similar for hosting that landfill in your community.
Jim, are we making more or less trash, more or less garbage than we used to?
Unfortunately, our trash going to solid waste facilities is staying pretty steady, slight increase. Just a couple of reasons is even though we are recycling more and more, we're buying more and more things, we're throwing out more and more things. So unfortunately, even with the best of the recycling programs, we're a pretty steady amount of trash being generated per person in the U.S.
Our disposable lives, huh?
Exactly.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for being here. Anytime I can talk trash, invite me back.
James Tingem is a professor in the College of Engineering at UW-Madison, where he teaches landfill design and management both in the classroom and in consulting across the country. Just ahead, we look at the political implications of our geography, how cities, small towns, and infrastructure can affect the outcome of our elections. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. Stay with us. More conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network.